Welcome, friends, to the Book of Nahum. I'm Melanie Hurlbut, and today we return to the story of Nineveh, the dreaded capital of Assyria, of Jonah fame. But by the time Nahum is preaching, more than 100 years later, Assyria has significantly changed. And so have Israel and Judah. Take a look with me for a minute at the dramatic changes in the political and religious landscape over the years from Jonah to Nahum. For us, arriving in Nahum's time feels a little bit like it did for the four Pevensey children, Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy, from The Lion and the Witch and the Wardrobe, who were summoned back into Narnia when Prince Caspian blew on Susan's magic horn. To their surprise, they encounter a radically changed landscape, with the ancient evil powers again on the move. And the children slowly come to recognize that the ruins among which they've taken refuge are all that is left of their beloved castle of Caer Paravel, from where they had once ruled Narnia. Likewise, as Nahum pulls us back into the world of Nineveh, to our surprise, we also encounter that ancient battle with evil, attempting to ruin God's good world. We discover that the northern kingdom of Israel, Jeroboam II's once great nation, is now a nation in ruins. Long gone are Israel's glory days, reduced to nothing but a memory. Like the Pevenseys, getting the backstory on their beloved Narnia, we need to unpack what has happened over the years from Jonah to Nahum, so we can better situate this prophecy against Nineveh within what God is doing in his world. Let's take a look at the northern kingdom of Israel, at Assyria, and Judah, each in turn, before we return to how this all fits with God's master plan to defeat evil and restore his kingdom on earth. How did the northern kingdom of Israel's glory days come to such a devastating end? Jeroboam II had ruled Israel for 41 years, the longest reign of any of the kings in the northern kingdom. Israel had thrived economically, been able to reconquer territories and restore her national borders. 2 Kings 14 tells us that the Lord had seen how bitterly everyone in Israel, whether slave or free, was suffering. There was no one to help them. And since the Lord had not said he would blot out the name of Israel from under heaven, he saved them. Jonah's preaching of repentance, despite his reluctance, had been part of this plan of God to turn Assyria from its brutal regional military expansion and give Israel some relief. Historians look back on this period of the Assyrian Empire and describe it as one of relative weakness. I always find this kind of historical assessment ironic. It shows up just how fallen our human values are from what God values. Assyria's weakness made it possible for God's people to recover and flourish. Israel was able to develop its agriculture, to expand its trade routes, and experience significant economic growth. Its resources and labor went to support their own national development, instead of the Assyrian Empire. Honestly, if that's weakness in an empire, then the world needs much more of it. But how did Israel respond to her God-given reprieve? Instead of being a light to the nations, part of the Lord's original call for Israel when he first rescued them from Egypt, the northern kingdom had responded to Assyrian weakness by grabbing at power for herself. The nation had grown wealthy, self-satisfied, and proud. As a result, the Lord had sent Amos to warn Israel of a coming day of judgment with scathing indictments against Israel's exploitation of its own people, graphically denouncing the wealthy as those who sell the poor for a pair of sandals. Think of it like the slave trade in England, when the Caribbean islanders suffered atrocities so that the British could enjoy sugar in their tea. Or closer to home, American consumers turning a blind eye to the international sweatshops in the supply chains of our favorite name-brand sneakers. Likewise, Hosea had called out Israel's idolatry. He had compared Israel to a prostitute who sold herself cheaply to whoever would offer a few coins. Israel had failed to recognize that God's kindness was intended to lead them to repentance. And instead, The nation had lost all knowledge of God. And so it wasn't long until new Assyrian kings ascended the throne, determined to make Assyria great again. About 750 BC, Tiglath-Pileser III had returned Assyria's foreign policy to one of aggressive territorial expansion. As a result, the northern kingdom of Israel didn't last long. Weakened internally by her own corruption, idolatry, and pride, Israel was carried into exile, bit by bit, over a 10-year period. Her capital, Samaria, finally fell to the Assyrian king Sargon II in 722 BC. Israel's 10 tribes were deported and scattered throughout Assyria. These tribes essentially lost all national identity, intermarrying with their neighbors to become unrecognizable as part of the Gentile nations of the world. A sad end for a once great nation through whom God had planned to redeem the world. So what did all this mean for Judah? What about her political and religious landscape? Could she hold on to her God-given calling to be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation? Hezekiah had been a bright light that had given the faithful in Judah great hope in the midst of a very dark time. Because of Ahaz, Hezekiah's father, Judah had turned its focus to imitating all of Assyria's ways. The Jews dressed like them and worshipped like them. Ahaz had even set up a replica of an Assyrian altar within God's temple in Jerusalem. But God would have none of it. And so, within a couple of decades after Israel's defeat, the Assyrian kings Sargon II and then Sennacherib had also invaded Judah, capturing 46 of her cities. Only Jerusalem remained, hanging by a thread. Remarkably, King Hezekiah, who had inherited his father's mess, had repented at Isaiah's preaching. He had led a citywide return to the Lord, much like Nineveh's king had listened to Jonah's preaching and led his city in repentance. As a result, in 701 BC, Jerusalem experienced a miraculous deliverance from Assyria's threatened siege. Jerusalem's faithful remnant put down its roots deeply into the Lord, enabling the now tiny city-state to survive for another 140 years. But the national repentance didn't last long. After Hezekiah's death, his son Manasseh worked overtime to return Judah to decadence and idolatry, keeping in step stride for stride with the nations of the world. So as we finally arrive in Nahum's time, Ashurbanipal is now ruler of Assyria, with his sights set on gathering the wealth of Egypt to fund the empire's expansion and prestige. He has recently demolished Egypt's ancient city of Thebes in 663, considered impregnable because of her strategic location on the Nile, and he has plundered its treasures. Because of an amazing archaeological find in 1854, we can still listen in today to Ashurbanipal's boasts that with weighty booty I left Thebes. Against Egypt and Cush I have lifted my spear and shown my power. With full hands, I have returned to Nineveh in good health. What hope is there for Judah and Jerusalem, on whom God has hung all his promises for the redemption of the world, against such brazen arrogance and power? And this is where we find Nahum, whose name means comfort, prophesying a word of comfort to the beleaguered, faithful remnant in Judah, giving them a message of hope in the Lord their God, that somehow his justice will prevail over the evil in the world. Do you feel beleaguered, weak and powerless in the midst of a sometimes evil world? I often do. Then join me now as we read Nahum together and hear with me from the Lord a word of comfort for our times.